All right, so we have talked about this before. It's worth talking about again, especially since things keep evolving. But Charles, you're deeply enmeshed in paying attention to all the details relevant to the kind of the connection between Trump's fascism and his kind of his Christology.
Right. As he was once famously asked, which of the testaments do you read the most? The Old Testament and the New Testament. He said both.
Playing it safe. Didn't want to offend the Old Testament people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we made him president anyway after that. He said that, I think, 2015. What is interesting is that a couple things came up over the last couple of weeks that are very much part of the rewriting of history of the United States that is part and parcel of the Christian nationalist movement, of which Trump has been a huge beneficiary.
I really don't think he cares, but he's been
Well, he
definitely.
doesn't care. I mean, but he understands that these are people who are very persuaded by his painting anybody who disagrees with him and his policies as somebody who hates the United States. And because there's this whole academic sort of wing that has really been banged very hard on the idea that this is and was founded as a Christian nation. It's very much part of the MAGA movement. It's almost inseparable from the MAGA movement, and it's also why some of the apostolic Protestants, have moved towards the MAGA movement, and have given it a lot of its exceptionalism. The exceptionalism being that only white Christians are really the true descendants of those from the Mayflower. And of course, the person who's more than Trump is the spokesman for this is Vance.
Vance, yeah.
Vance, you know,
I
I mean, he's a
thought
real
you were
blues.
going to say Stephen Miller.
Well, Steve Miller, obviously,
Yeah.
but Vance is out there, talking essentially a sanitized blood and soil kind of view.
Tell me about blood and soil.
Well, it's the push against the idea that a nation of immigrants, of diverse peoples, is stronger than one that was homogeneous. And the homogeneous nation, which of course you could read as the Aryan nation, as it was called in the 1930s, are really the only ones who can push the United States forward. And it also is why so much of the past. It's a backward-looking movement. It was a backward-looking movement in Nazi Germany too, in the 30s. It was looking backwards, and that's what they're doing. And what they're doing is, particularly like in the recent move to put the signs on the Smithsonian American History Museum, put the signs outside it because they couldn't put it in it because the Smithsonian's a private institution, but the Park Service owns the sidewalks
Science
outside.
saying.
That there's misinformation inside, and then you should go to this
Like
website.
slavery was bad, for example.
Well, that slavery wasn't all that bad because the slaves learned some skills. They learned some work skills.
Native Americans weren't the victims of
The
attempted
point
genocide.
is that they claim that everything in the museum or the thrust of the museum is to say things that, while they may be historically true, it's a point of emphasis. And that they downplay all the greatness and exceptionalism in the United States. Right. And to the point, of course, that a lot of it is that they want to rewrite the history entirely. I mean, so, this whole let's look at January 6th, right?
2021.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole history of that is being rewritten by Trump, right? It was patriots, right, who were trying to take back the country from the elites, right? And they were duped by all the FBI agents and informants who were really the ones who were pushing them
Who are
forward.
waving them in?
Right, correct.
Right,
Well, they
yeah.
said, yes, they were talking, that was the police who didn't want to get trampled and beaten up with flagpoles that may have waved them in. But there, and rewriting history means you also have to go back and rewrite it. And so anything that's in a museum that says, well, this is what slavery was, this is who benefited from slavery, has to be recast.
Yeah.
And
So,
that's kind of the thrust. It's a very classic authoritarian thrust.
tell me where I'm wrong. The original colonists, whether they be Dutch or English or French, were often, not always, they were coming for opportunities sometimes, but oftentimes they were fleeing religious persecution. They were religious, they were Christian. They were often,
not all of them.
No, but they were often coming from, most of them, I would think. So, I can see how the right would make that argument. I can see the foundation on which they're trying to build it. But it totally bypasses the fact that, yeah, not all early Americans were of the, you know, were of the same united, you know, same Christian perspective. And the Constitution is pretty clear about the separation of religion from the workings of government.
Well, that of course is the biggest, you know, roadblock. And, you know, you have a judiciary that was brought up in the Federalist Society, which is very much about saying that that's a misreading of the Constitution.
Now, how do they read it?
That there's nothing in there that says that, it simply says you can't establish a state religion. In other words, you can't thrust onto the people a religion that the state determines is the only one that matters. But
that's what a white Christian nationalist nation, or that's what
that's
about.
Well, of course, that's the whole point. That's exactly what they would be doing by excluding others who don't believe the same way they do.
Right.
You know, that Jesus is their savior. And, you know, the real problem they have is the very people who wrote the Constitution hated organized religion. If you read Jefferson, you read Madison.
Franklin as well, you know, I imagine.
And Franklin, Paine, they, especially Madison and Jefferson, blamed the organized churches of Europe for most of the strife on the continent. And the last thing they wanted was to have a religious basis for the United States.
So how come the political left or right or whatever you want to call the people who don't want to see a religious state established here, how come they don't cite those readings more often?
Because it's like the Bible. You just pick the ones that fit what you want people to believe.
But the readings of Paine and Jefferson, Madison.
Why don't they?
Yeah, how come we aren't hearing those more often? How they were opposed to the establishment of a
Because this religion. This has been a project of many, many years. Heritage Foundation,
sure.
Federalist, bunch of other organizations, a fundamentalist.
Supreme Court.
Apostolic Christianity. Supreme Court, obviously, yeah. is a product of that. It's an inconvenient truth. Right? Yeah. The Federalist Papers are pretty clear. So I
would think our side, those of us who value the separation of church and state, would be reading that stuff constantly, citing it constantly, talking about it all the time.
Because the media never goes past the First Order.
No.
All they ever say is the Constitution, you know, says that there's a separation between church and state. Those words aren't in the Constitution. The words taken together come up with that, right?
So some media. I'm setting us up for a future conversation, maybe actually probably multiple conversations about these readings from early Americans who did not want to see a church established in the U.S.
Well, no, it's probably the number one person who didn't want a church established in the United States was Jefferson. Jefferson, I think, spent after he was president, spent most of the rest of his life rewriting the Bible in a way that was a lot less about a anthropomorphized male god and more about a more universalist version of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not surprising that a group of organization and philosophers and thinkers who believes that authoritarianism and concentrated power in some sort of sovereign would be a better way to rule than a messy democratic republic. So they fit their religious iconography and interpretations to fit what they want to have.
So let's talk about something happening here in Iowa. Then I want to ask you a big picture question. But you're here in Iowa, the Republican trifecta at the State House established the Center for Intellectual Freedom, and I believe at the University of Iowa.
Yeah.
And you're a big fan.
Well, you know, it comes from, if you look at it from a non-tribal side, you know, it's trying to address something that is truly absent in American education, which is a true civics course, right? You know,
but where they're coming from is...
Well, hold on a second. Okay, but I mean, there's nothing wrong with teaching civics. It should have been taught way before you go into college.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, this is how you end up with, you know, if not the most illiterate senator in the Senate, U.S. Senate, the second most illiterate senator, Tommy Tuberville, who believes that there's only two branches of government. Okay.
Has he said that?
Yeah.
And they are?
I think he included the military as the third branch. He left out the courts.
Okay, well.
So there is a need for teaching civics. We're obviously doing a pretty crummy job. In fact, you know, I think they've done studies where they take the test that they give for naturalization for immigrants, and they give it to, like, Americans who were born here.
And they fail.
And a huge percentage of can't pass any of the information about our country. So anyway, they put this together, and, of course, the subtext of this was that it was a necessary corrective to the fact that most universities have a liberal, progressive lean to their faculties. And I think that's true. That, you know, most of the large universities and elite colleges, for the most part, are predominantly people who would agree with you and I on many, many things. And everybody figured out this... You know, the curriculum is still not even together, right? They had like a one credit course that they ran this year, and they only got, they had 64 spots and only 21 were filled. The rumor, I think, or one of the articles I read about it, was that there was only one person enrolled for next year, which is when they decided that maybe they need to rethink writing a curriculum. And also, you know, the legislature, from what I understand, is trying to push U of I or push the regents into forcing U of I to make it a required course.
Well, and again, part of where this is coming from is the Iowa Republican legislature's kind of conservative Christian bent.
Well, it will be. I assume a lot of it will be like listening to that professor at Hillsdale, Hansen.
He's
You know, it'll be about American exceptionalism.
Yeah.
You know.
So let me ask you, I mean...
And if anything, I would say that our present times really call into question American exceptionalism. It seems to me that what we're seeing is we're just as bad as any other nationalist state ever has been, you know, in terms of being able to...
Empires specifically.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. We've been around a long time. We remember when the kind of radical Christian extremism was really just on the fringe. The moral majority, and, you know, I mean, it was having an impact, but right now it has reached the highest level of office. It is embedded in the administration with people like Stephen Miller and J.D. Vance and Russell Bowen.
Hold on a second. I mean, Stephen Miller's not even a Christian.
Yeah, but he'll be happy to use elements of Christianity to establish, I think the guy's basically a fascist.
And bringing
Christianity and fascism together works as a totalitarian mix, just like we've seen religion and fascism work very well in other countries of the world, not necessarily Christian but Muslim. Let me just say it, Jewish. I mean, what's happening right now in Israel? I mean, how is that not as bad as any mix of faith and politics? But I think here, It's heading that way. It's heading that way. And are we quick enough to the draw to be able to cut it off?
I don't know. I mean, it's the end result of a project that started in the 1970s, which was the Republicans' realization that fundamentalists / apostolic Christians could be manipulated into aligning with the Republican Party on the issue of abortion. Remember, the Republican Party was not anti-abortion legalization until the 70s. And in fact, it didn't even come upon the issue until years after Roe v. Wade, probably mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you had Paul Weyrich and other operatives, you know, like Phyllis Schlafly, who saw that as an issue. What's happened is the dog caught the car, which is the Republicans, just, you know, like the industrialists thought they can control Hitler, the Republicans thought, this is great, we'll just keep stringing this issue along for as long as we can, and that will get us the support from this group of fundamentalist, you know, Christians, mostly Protestant sects, and some of the more Opus Dei type Roman Catholics. And now they've caught the party. They're running the show, and that's exactly right. And they are definitely infiltrated in multiple levels of the federal government, and that is a little bit scary.
Yeah, and we talk about this a lot, but there's always something new breaking. What's your status right now, Doctor, as to the life support system of democracy? How's it looking?
We're definitely in critical care. You know, we're in the ICU. And I don't think that... I think the salvation may be that we only have a couple of more months before on the downside of what should be the last 2 years of the Trump administration. And, you know, he becomes a lot less powerful.
When he doesn't have a...
When he doesn't, yeah.
Compliant Republican Congress.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I think it would be something if he even had a Republican Congress that wasn't compliant. But gosh, when you see folks like Bill Cassidy, who have nothing to lose by standing up for what they say they believe in, caving, you know?
Actually, I mean, for Iowans, I think it's a sad watch, but most Iowans should take a look at the opening of the Judiciary Committee, you know, when they considered and passed the nomination of Todd Blanche on. Senator Grassley opened with a discussion of why Blanche was a great choice, including how he personally brought down the murder rate in the United States since 2022, of course. But it was sad. It was sad to watch somebody who, you know, I've interacted with and found him astute and, you know, a real public... Well, yeah. One time he was a real public servant.
Chuck Grassley has the aw shucks. I'm the farm boy senator.
But more than that, I mean, he was somebody who understood the issues.
Yeah, and he was also independent.
Right.
I mean, I voted for him once, Charles. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't know that.
Well, he and Mark Hatfield, the only two Republicans who opposed going to war the first time we went to war with Iraq,
mm-hmm.
He was one of two Republicans who voted no.
Well, you should watch. It's only a 10-minute speech, but it's hard to watch.
Okay, I will watch it, but he's been hard to watch for the past 20, 30 years now. And it's just gotten worse and worse under Trump. And I'm afraid that's happened to other Republican, you know, lawmakers who may have at one time had an independent backbone.
Mm-hmm.
but you know, you still see some that do express independence and exercise their own discernment. And then what happens? Well, go talk to Thomas Massie or Bill Cassidy or Cornyn in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now there's a guy in charge of the Republican Party, and if you don't stay in line with him, you're in trouble. And I'm just wondering, Charles, you said, you know, democracy is in the ICU, but I'm feeling very encouraged by America's physicians, and that would be the voters, the independent media, the independent judicial. I mean, we do have judiciary members of the judiciary who do still value independent thought. I mean, heck, Jeanine Pirro. I mean, voting against Trump's position on the reflecting pool, small potatoes maybe, but a significant stand that now has her in trouble. But good for her. I honestly anybody could have looked at the evidence and come up with a different conclusion, but still good for her. So, you know, we may be in the ICU, but I see a collective of physicians and other medical personnel that are pulling the right strings and making the right decisions. And, you know, if we can keep that going, I'd say we still have a shot at pulling democracy out of the ICU.
Well, I certainly hope so.
But you don't share my optimism.
At times I do. At times I do. I mean,
after a rousing speech like I just gave.
Exactly. Well, if the last thing I'll say is, if we want that to happen, we need to get rid of all political consultants. We need people who are campaigning and saying, this is what I believe.
I despise political consultants. I'm with you on that.